If it seems like male authors get more attention, well, there are hard numbers to back that up. It's something called the Vita Count. Vita is a women's literary organization, and the count is the result of 8 months of tracking gender disparity in leading publications. It looks at the gender of authors whose books are being reviewed and the gender of those doing the reviewing. Here's NPR's Lynn Neary.
The Vita numbers have changed very little over the last 4 years. The Atlantic, the London Review of Books, the New Republic, and The Nation have all had an overall ratio of 75 men to 25 women. That includes reviewers and those reviewed. At the New York Review of Books, it's 80-20. Vita's count director, Jen Fitzgerald, says the numbers are so clear, they're starting to change the conversation.
We have these stark blue and red charts that offer up data, and there's no negating it. When we present it, it's no longer a question of, is there an imbalance? Now it's a question of, why is there an imbalance? Do we want to change the imbalance? You know, the initial shock of, oh my goodness, are we really seeing 75% men across the board? To a question of, why are editors okay with 75% men across the board?
To say that the Vita Count is an eagerly awaited event in the book world would not be exactly accurate. A couple of years ago, the editor of the Times Literary Supplement famously said his publication didn't plan to make, quote, a fetish of having 50-50 contributions by men and women book reviewers. And the New Republic did some research showing there are more male than female authors, which could explain why more books written by men get reviewed.
I don't know the numbers in terms of what's being published, how many books are by women and how many books are by men.
Pamela Paul is the editor of the New York Times Book Review, which showed improvement in this year's Vita count. In 2013, the number of male and female book reviewers in the Times was almost equal, and they reviewed 332 books written by women and 482 by men. Paul took over as editor during that time and says diversifying the book review section was a priority for her.
It is not hard work at all. That's the big secret. It's not hard. There are so many good books out there by women, and there are so many incredibly good book critics out there who are women. So I actually have to say that I didn't find it to be an incredible strain. I don't think any of our editors at the Book Review felt like, you know, we were unduly burdened.
Near the bottom of the Vita count this year, the New Republic, which released a statement acknowledging that its numbers look, quote, more what you would expect from 1964 than 2014, and promising that this would change in the future. Harper's was in that 75 to 25% group, but Deputy Editor Christopher Bahar says that represents a 10% improvement for his publication. Bahar says in the future, some deeply ingrained habits will have to change.
You can have a long-term vision of gender equality, but if you have an institutional history in which, you know, you've got a stable of writers who are more male than female, and the day-to-day when you're trying to get the magazine out, it's just often easier to rely on the people who you've relied on in the past.
But Bahar says other changes are needed, too. He contends men and women approach the magazine differently with ideas, and that may also affect the numbers.
Speaking broadly, of course, a male writer comes to you with an idea, and you say, this isn't quite right for us, you know, try us again. If I say that, try us again, in my email, I'm going to get a response the next day with three new ideas. And there is a tendency, I think, among female writers to emphasize the this isn't right for us part rather than the try again part.
Vita's numbers may have raised awareness of the problem of gender disparity, but the conversation on how to solve it continues. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's been 16 years since acclaimed writer Laurie Moore has brought out a new short story collection. Her new collection is called Bark, and book critic Maureen Corrigan is sitting up and taking notice.
Laurie Moore isn't quite a household name. This was news to me because I thought that, given that she's the kind of writer who's published in The New Yorker and profiled in The New York Times, most culture vultures would know who she is. But over the past couple of weeks, when I mentioned her new book, Bark, in conversations, both in the halls of academe and over meals with friends, I mostly got blank stares. One smarty confused her with that other great literary Laurie, the late Laurie Colwin, whose short stories and novels are also essential reading. Maybe Laurie Moore's muzzy kind of literary fame is due to the fact she doesn't publish a lot. A warp speed wonder like Joyce Carol Oates publishes 20 books in the time it takes for Lori Moore to crank out a story. But she's almost always worth the wait. There are 8 stories in this collection whose frivolous title, Bark, refers to both the stray roving dog and to the stuff that covers trees. For me, the long first story, called Debarking, is itself worth the price of this book. Debarking is about a guy named Ira, who's newly divorced from his former wife, Marilyn. Here's Moore's trademark digressive, loopy narrative voice explaining why Ira hasn't yet removed his wedding ring. The ring, supposedly gold, though now that everything Ira had ever received from Marilyn had been thrown into doubt, who knew, cinched the blousy fat of his finger, which had grown around it like a happy vine. The rest of the story concerns Ira's stumbling attempts to start a relationship with a woman who's too physically attached to her own teenage son. In the background, the way world events usually do provide the background to our own private dramas, the U.S. invasion of Iraq is about to begin. Ira so desperately wants to be settled again, to take cover in the safe bunker of marriage and escape this grim world of middle-aged dating and sad weekly visits from his little daughter, who he reflects is now rudely transported between houses in a speedy, ritualistic manner resembling a hostage drop-off. Ira, though, is too raw. Moore makes you feel for him, and at the same time, she makes you want to push off the weight of Ira, all his exposed, sappy neediness, far away. Although Moore has said she finds short story collections organized around a theme contrived, many of the other stories in Bark also mull over the shock of sudden aloneness after a relationship has collapsed or someone has died. The Juniper Tree is a ghost story in which a college professor is visited by the taunting specter of a friend who's just died from cancer. Even the concluding story, Thank You for Having Me, which is about a wedding, folds in this simultaneously irreverent and profound riff on death and loss. The unnamed wedding guest, a single mom, tells us that it felt important spiritually to go to weddings, to give balance to the wakes and memorial services. And without weddings, there were only funerals. I had seen a soccer mom become a rhododendron with a plaque next to the soccer field parking lot, as if it had been watching all those soccer matches that had killed her. I had seen a brilliant young student become a creative writing contest, as if it were all that writing that had been the thing to do him in. I had seen a dozen people become hunks of rock, with their names engraved so shockingly perfect upon the surface, it looked as if they had indeed turned to stone. Not every story in Bark is so memorable. In fact, I'd say there are even numbers of clunkers and keepers here. But Moore is such an original, I'm not complaining too much. No other writer would think of the peeled-off exposure of divorce in terms of debarking. No other writer lights on descriptions like the old silver jewelry smell of oncoming rain. Well, okay, maybe one other writer would. Moore does remind me of that other American original, Emily Dickinson. They share a love for puns, an unpremeditated oddness, and an abiding sense of solitariness. Dickinson didn't publish enough either, at least in her lifetime, but she too was pretty much worth the wait.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lori Moore's new collection of stories called Bark.
Leah Vincent had already traveled an amazing distance by the time she was an adult. Vincent grew up in a yeshivish community in Pennsylvania, but was forced to leave as a teenager and eventually ended up cut off completely, alone in New York City. The yeshivish are an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect. Religion is at the center of their life, and strict rules regulate all daily activities. Especially restricted are any interactions with the opposite sex. But Leah says when she was young, the rules didn't feel oppressive.
When I was a child, it was really a beautiful and wonderful thing. You know, I was one of 11 children, and it was kind of easy to get lost in that. But I felt like I was doing what God wanted, and that imbued my daily life with so much meaning and joy and intensity, which was really very wonderful to feel like God had reached down from the sky and tapped me on the shoulder and chosen me to be his daughter, which is how it was phrased to us. It was only once my adolescence started to unfold and I started to have desires and interests that went beyond the world I was supposed to fit into that things started to become more tense and there more conflicts arose.
And those desires, what happens is you end up expressing them in a way which outside of the community would look quite innocuous and even kind of sweet and innocent. Can you talk about how that came to pass?
Sure. So there were a few big moments that really symbolized this tension that was building. One of them was I was sent away to a more yeshivish, more religious school in Manchester, England, and I befriended a girl who had a very cute older brother. And girls were not allowed to talk to boys, but because he was my friend's older brother, I had some contact with him. And he was not as yeshivish as my family, and he introduced me to the idea of going to college, that one could be religious and a good person and still go to college, which was forbidden in my sect. And maybe I was, probably pretty heavily influenced by the fact that I was 15 and had a major crush on this guy. But I started thinking, I want to go to college. And I called my mom back home in Pittsburgh and I said, I am thinking about going to college. It's something I want to do. And she said, if you try to go to college, we'll have you locked up. So they reacted very strongly to this desire. And then a little bit later on, I was in Israel. It was found out that I had been writing letters to the same boy. And it really led to a big break between me and my extended family and my community.
And you were just, as you said, you were just exchanging notes with this boy. But that was something that was absolutely forbidden, unacceptable.
Yeah, there was not allowed to be any contact between adolescent girls and boys. And once it was known that I was talking to a boy, I immediately moved to sort of a second-class citizenship because, I wasn't pure, I wasn't good, I had violated some taboo. And I just ended up in this precarious position where I was branded a rebel and a bad girl, but I had no desire of my own to move out into the world. I still loved our way of life. I had just made a few mistakes.
Well, it's one of the things that's so sad about this part of your journey is that it's not like you're not a non-believer. You're not even questioning your faith, your belief in God, or even the morality of it that deeply. It's just a couple of things that completely turn it upside down for you.
Yeah, I'm almost embarrassed now when I share stories with other people who have similar journeys. Like, I wasn't the feminist. I wasn't the forward-thinking intellectual. I just was a teenager, and I made some mistakes, but I desperately for years clung to this desire to stay within the world I grew up in.
So how did you wind up in New York City?
So that was kind of a common move. That's where the really large yeshivish community is, and so people who have families outside of that will send their daughters and their sons to New York to be matched up by a matchmaker to get married. So that was kind of expected. What was unexpected was the lack of support and communication that came along with that. So I was 17 in New York City, and nobody was trying to find me. Nobody was talking about, okay, soon we'll try to find you a match. Nobody was really talking to me, period. So I was in the right place, but nothing else was lined up.
And what's also hard to imagine, so you grew up, to put it mildly, in a very sheltered you had a very sheltered childhood, but then you're in New York City, kind of sin central.
Yeah. And, perhaps another way to talk about it is that this is a story about a lot of sex and sexual trauma, and yet I grew up in I don't know if that's the synonym for sin that you're looking at, but that I grew up in this very sheltered world. But I actually think it's not as paradoxical as it might look at first glance, because I think when girls are raised in communities or homes that obsess over modesty, they're actually, it's just like a dust cloth over this sexuality that ends up defining them. And when they're put in other circumstances, it leaves them very vulnerable to the kind of things that I went through. I was raised where my most important goal was to always stay modest because I believe I had some huge sexual power that could cause men to sin. And engaging with that power in different ways, most of them unhealthily at the beginning, became a coping mechanism. But I think if I was raised in a home where I had been taught that I had many tools and many things that were important about my life and many things I could contribute to the world, I think that it wouldn't have been my life would not have gone from one extreme to the other as it did.
Do you have any communication now with your family or your old community?
Most of my family won't speak to me anymore. But as I mentioned in the book, I have one brother who also left ultra-Orthodoxy after I did, and he and I have a wonderful relationship, and he has a family, and it's so beautiful. After having lost everybody, he has a son, and I have a daughter, and they can play together, and I can know that I'm giving my child some family, even though I lost so much.
Leah Vincent's new book is called Cut Me Loose, Sin and Salvation After My Ultra-Orthodox Girlhood. Leah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Michio Kaku is famous for explaining some of the weirder mysteries of the universe in books like Hyperspace. But he has shifted his attention to a much smaller system, the brain. Kaku shifts from physics to neuroscience for his new book called The Future of the Mind. He says we can think of the brain as a large corporation.
Now, we used to think the brain was like a computer. But now we realize that's not true. There's no programming of the brain. There's no Windows. And we think the brain is more like a large corporation. Because think of the unconscious mind. In a corporation, you have subdivisions which operate independently of the main office. And that's why we have an unconscious mind, because you have to have, for example, emotional reactions to things very quickly. And so the organization of the brain is, in some sense, very much like a large bureaucracy.
I know this is something you wrestle with in the book. How does something like consciousness emerge out of this corporation?
Well, consciousness, there are about 20,000 papers on consciousness with no consensus. Nowhere in history have so many people devoted so much time to produce so little. But our consciousness differs because we simulate the future. Animals have no conception of tomorrow. We do. We constantly are daydreaming, constantly planning for tomorrow, constantly thinking about things that happen even beyond our lifetime.
It sounds related to a similar definition that I've heard in the past from philosophers, that what sets us apart is that a knowledge of our own mortality, the idea that there will one day not be a me.
That's right. We can imagine things far beyond our body. And so these are three levels of consciousness. Consciousness one level is understanding where we are in space. Consciousness two is where we understand our position in society, who's top dog, who's underdog, and who's in the middle. And type three consciousness is simulating the future. And type three consciousness, only humans have this ability to see far into the future.
Can you talk about what modern technology has been able to tell us about the mystery of consciousness?
Well, we've learned more in the last 10, 15 years than in all of human history. In fact, we can take the consciousness of somebody who is totally paralyzed, cannot do anything with their body, put a chip in their brain, and have that person control a laptop. They can now surf the web. They can now write emails, answer emails, control their wheelchair, control household appliances, and even manipulate mechanical arms and eventually a mechanical exoskeleton. Stephen Hawking, my colleague, is totally paralyzed, and he has a chip in his right glass. Next time you see him on television, look at his right frame, and you see a brain sensor, which picks up radio from his brain and allows him to type mentally.
And the fact that our brains and bodies can interface with machines in this way, what does that tell us about, you know, our idea of ourself and our consciousness?
Well, President Barack Obama stunned the scientific community last year in his State of the Union address, announcing the Brain Project. Just like the Human Genome Project revolutionized genetics and medicine, the Brain Project of America and the European Union will allocate over $1 billion to map all the sequences and pathways of the human brain. The short-term goal is to understand and cure mental illness, one of the greatest afflictions in the history of the human race. The Bible mentions mental illness, for example. And even beyond that, if you have a CD-ROM with all our pathways on it, that's sort of like Brain 2.0. Philosophers have asked the question, if we have a CD-ROM with all our neural pathways on it, perhaps consciousness is nothing but information, and this information can live forever. This has philosophical implications.
Couldn't you say that that's kind of reductive, though, that just because these processes can be mirrored by machines or even, you know, mimicked by machines, you're still, that's not the same as if you're mapping out all the neurons. That's not the same thing as getting the essence of a person, of that self.
Well, it all depends on how you define the word you. What are you? if you are a mass of soft tissue and bones and so on and so forth, then you're absolutely right. These things look like no more than sophisticated tape recorders. They are not conscious in the sense that our neurons are conscious. But if that set of neurons, mechanical transistors, eventually becomes so sophisticated it's basically a carbon copy, then perhaps there's a new definition of you. Perhaps you can exist independent of your body. Now, of course, we've seen this on Star Trek. We've seen this in the movies. But now things that we think of as science fiction are now entering the laboratories of people working on this brain initiative, this $1 billion initiative to understand mental illness and what is the human consciousness.
Would you want your brain to be downloaded to have a copy made of your mind?
Well, you know, in the movie Back to the Future, Doc Brown is asked the question, do you want to see the future? And he says, I've always wanted to see beyond my years.
I've always dreamed of seeing the future, looking beyond my years, seeing the progress of mankind.
Why not?
I'd also be able to see who wins the next 25 World Series.
You see, I'm also a futurist. I dream about the world 50, 100, maybe even 1,000 years into the future, but I also realize I'm probably not going to see it. However, I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind having at least a copy of myself see the future, maybe 50, 100, 1,000 years into the future. It would be a fantastic ride.
Michio Kaku's new book is called The Future of the Mind. Thank you so much.
Glad to be on your show.
A group of our Morning Edition colleagues went to the White House a few years ago to interview President Obama. Now, a sit-down with the president is always news, but there was other news of a more personal kind going on behind the scenes. And that's a story we can now tell.
The story involved Madalika Sicca. She is now the executive editor of NPR News, and she went along with me as we recorded that interview and produced it for broadcast. Now, what I remember about that day was walking into the Oval Office, sitting with the president, then racing out to the White House press area. Her memories are different. What do you remember from that day?
Quite a blur.
A blur because as we were talking with the president, Madalika was waiting on a personal phone call, a phone call from her doctor. She'd been warned just a few days before that the news might not be good.
I said to my doctor, I said, well, I'm going to focus on this interview with the president. But you're going to get the results on Thursday rather than wait for me to hear from a radiologist on Friday. And this is my internist, who's not a cancer specialist. She's like, I'll find you.
The doctor reached her by phone at the White House just minutes after the interview. She had breast cancer. Our friend and colleague has now written of what happened next in a book she calls A Breast Cancer Alphabet. It is less a memoir than a guide for others starting the process that Madalika began. It works through the disease from A to Z. For example, letter G, which stands for guilt. She asked, as many people do, if she brought the cancer on herself.
There's no history of breast cancer in my family. So I think about what could have caused this. You know, eating badly or waiting to have your kids or being on the pill.
You've got a checklist here. Being a woman, guilty. Getting older, guilty. Genetic inheritance, not guilty.
And
you went through the list.
I went through the list because you kind of start thinking, well, what did I do? How come this happened to me? I must have done something wrong. And there's a really good chance that you didn't. It's a cellular malfunction and it sucks, but it's a cellular malfunction. So that's one facet of guilt. The other facet of guilt is people like to point out how lucky you are when you tell them your story. Oh, you found it. Oh, you have great doctors.
And good, it's only stage one or two,
yeah,
or not four.
People love to, and they're trying to make you feel better. You know, like, oh, I knew someone who had this, and I felt I didn't need to get into sort of a competition with somebody else's cancer.
You're tempted to say to yourself, don't feel sorry for yourself. You know, other people have it worse. But you're arguing you don't need to say that to yourself.
You don't need to say that all the time and live that all the time. Yes, occasionally you can wallow. It's okay. You don't have to put on that brave face kind of thing that we've gotten used to in the whole sort of breast cancer culture.
And when you mention breast cancer culture, the chapter on W is warrior, and I would imagine you can quote the first sentence of that chapter from memory.
I'm not a warrior.
What do you mean?
I'm a woman who had breast cancer. I understand that it's helpful for a lot of people to look at their experience through that lens, that you have to sort of fight and kick its ass and all these sort of martial comparisons.
Is that what the common approach is?
I think that's the common approach. I think that that's what we expect of people. Oh, you know, you can kick it. The reverse of that is if somehow you are unfortunate enough not to survive, that you didn't fight it, that you weren't a warrior. And that is not the reality either. It's a disease. And I don't see that kind of language being used in the same way with so many other diseases, including, frankly, lots of other cancers.
There aren't a lot of prostate cancer warriors out there,
no.
I suppose.
No. And they're not pink.
Is there something self-defeating about that attitude? Or is it just not right for you?
It wasn't right for me. And it's not right for a lot of women. And that is one thing I did learn by expressing this. And I'm not saying that there aren't days when you are feeling like that, but it doesn't have to be the whole of it.
Did the experience change you?
I pause because my first reaction is no. And it's a very visceral reaction because that ascribes something mystical to the experience of going through breast cancer. And I just don't ascribe to that. Your life goes on. You've got to manage your disease and your life and your family and everything else.
The people in your life.
The people
their
in
lives
your life.
On.
And their lives are affected by it. And you find yourself sort of wishing that everything was back the way it was.
Listening to you, I'm realizing that it seems that you discovered that there is a wide range of expectations. People have all these ideas about what they should say to someone who has cancer, how they should feel when they have cancer,
mm-hmm.
how they should respond to the treatment, what attitude they should take. And those expectations just didn't fit you, your personality, or your life, and you found that a little annoying.
Yeah, I was a little annoyed, but I appreciated that once you start talking to people, you know, I had known people who had gone through it, and it's like you belong to a little club. And, you know, there was somebody who I knew who I thought on the outside, I was like, wow, she's been amazing through this. And she revealed to me that, you know, you're going to get up in the middle of the night and you're going to feel awful and you're going to look at yourself in the mirror and it's going to scare you. Because you are bald and you have no eyebrows and your skin is, you know, sallow and gray and it's horrible. Thank you for telling me that. I want to tell other people that.
People will want to know, so I'll ask. You look great. How are you doing now?
I'm doing fine. I'm on drugs, which, you know, thousands of women are. And the point of the drugs is to reduce the risk of recurrence. It's why I'm not a fan of the word survivor, because I feel survivor suggests an end. You know, you're diagnosed and you have your treatment, so there's a beginning, middle, and end. I feel good. I have great doctors. I'm on drugs. They have side effects. But right now, I don't have cancer, so I have my hair back. And more importantly, I have my eyebrows back. So I feel
kind of hard to wear an eyebrow wig, I suppose.
It's really hard to paint your eyebrows, actually, I discovered during that period.
Will it ever be over?
No. I think, you know, my opening essay is A for Anxiety. There's always a little bit of anxiety that will remain. You don't live in a permanent crouch of fear, but it's just somewhere in the back of your head, and it recedes over time, but you have to be vigilant.
Metallica Sicka is the executive editor of NPR News and the author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.